I got to tell you about what we're going to start next week, because the next probably 5 weeks at Hub City are guaranteed to offend somebody, because we're going to talk about our big mouths for the next 5 weeks. We're going to have a series on our words, and I don't know about you, but maybe you're like perfect in everything you say, but I know you, and most of you have put your foot in your mouth at one time or another. And we're going to talk about that. And some of you are like elbowing your spouse right now because you want them to hear what we're going to say. But it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited about it. We're going to talk about what we say online. We're going to talk about what we say in relationships. We're going to talk about how our words get us in trouble. It's going to be a fun, fun series that I guarantee will be an equal opportunity offending series. And speaking of offense, and offending one another, we're going to have a group confession time. Actually, we're going to play the group confession game, because I like to play the group confession game to start us off this morning. And so this is a group confession question. How many of you have ever been wrong about something at any time in your life? Raise your hand. If you're not raising your hand, you're wrong. right now. Seriously, the truth is all of us in this room have been wrong at one time or another in our lives about something. Some of us have been wrong more often than others. Some of you were wrong on the way to church this morning, and that that's why it was kind of a rough morning for you on the way here, because you were wrong about something. But when you're wrong about something, you know that a consequence of being wrong is you kind of have to have a change in your behavior, or maybe a change in your response, or a change in your attitude. And that change is usually exhibited by saying things like, "I am sorry, I was wrong," right? Some of you are really, you like those words are the most difficult words for you to say, right? You know, it's really hard for you to say, "Sorry, I was wrong." And some of you are like smiling at me because you know that other people have told you that you have trouble saying that. But that's because when we're wrong about something, we know that in order to make things right, there has to be some sort of a change. Well, this morning, we're going to discover that many of us in this room have been wrong about something that we hold really, really dear. And as a result of us realizing that we've been wrong about this, we're going to have to make a change. And that change is going to make us a little uncomfortable. That change is probably going to make some of us in this room a little bit mad, a little bit angry, a little bit on edge. You may not like me after today a little bit. But if we would admit that we're wrong about this one thing, it has the potential to, I think, not just transform our lives, but how we live our lives and how we interact with this world that God has put us in. And to get us there, we're going to be looking at something that Jesus said out of Matthew chapter 16. So if you have your Bible, you can open up to Matthew 16. And we read these verses this morning, or Gary did, before his little carrot cake spiel. Thanks for filling me in on that, Gary. I had no idea. I feel like I was enlightened today. I don't even know where. I expect a carrot cake at my house this afternoon since you live in my neighborhood. But we're going to be in Matthew chapter 16 this morning, and let me kind of tell you what's going on here so that you kind of understand the context, because it's pretty cool. Jesus and his disciples had just experienced this marathon of healing and teaching and exposure, and he and his disciples needed a break. I mean, they were exhausted. They needed a little bit of rest and relaxation. And so what they did was they took off to this area called Caesarea Philippi for some much needed R&R. And I don't know if you know anything about Caesarea Philippi, but it was about 25 miles to the northeast of the Sea of Galilee. And it was a non-Jewish city, which meant that it was a great place for Jewish Jesus and his Jewish disciples to get away from the Jewish crowds that had been following him everywhere. So he takes them off to this non-Jewish city, Caesarea Philippi, for a break. But something else that you might want to know about Caesarea Philippi is, since it was a non-Jewish city, it was a very pagan city. In fact, it was known for the number of pagan temples that they had throughout the city. In fact, some of their worship practices in this pagan city of Caesarea Philippi were so odd and weird that they are not acceptable for me to share in our PG-related service this morning. But you should go and look up Caesarea Philippi and figure out what happened there, because it was, I told my hub group this on Wednesday what it was, and they don't want me to share, do you? I mean, it was really, that's the city that Jesus takes his disciples to for some rest and relaxation. So let that sink in for a minute. It's like Jesus taking his disciples to Vegas. I almost said it's almost like a Baptist going to Vegas, you know, for rest and relaxation. You know what I mean? It's just not what you would think happened. But this city that Jesus takes his disciples to becomes the backdrop for a very important teaching, for something new that Jesus wanted to introduce to his disciples. And that's what we're going to read this morning. And we're going to start reading in verse 13. And this is what it says. It says, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do the people say the Son of Man is? Like, hey guys, what's the word on the street about me? Like, what are people saying about me? You've heard people talking, you know, you've heard the whispers and the murmurs. What's going on? What are people saying about me? And they replied, verse 14, they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And I find this list kind of interesting because basically what people were saying about Jesus was that he was somebody from the past who'd come back to life. Like he was John the Baptist who'd come back from the dead, because just a little while ago, John the Baptist had been beheaded. But, you know, if you remember that story, and then, or maybe he was one of these prophets from way back in the day who had come back to life. That's who people were saying Jesus was, which I find interesting because nobody was saying that Jesus was somebody different or somebody new. Basically, the word on the street about Jesus was that he was just a rehash of some past prophet. That's what they were saying. That's the word on the street about him. He's just a rehash of a has-been. But then Jesus switches up the question. Verse 15. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say that I am? Like, forget about what everybody else says. You guys have been hanging out with me for a little while. Who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, if you know anything about Peter, it shouldn't surprise you that Peter's the first one to open his mouth. He's always the first one to open his mouth. But the surprising thing about Peter's response here is actually what he says. He says out loud what, for the first time that we know of, this declaration of who Jesus is. Like, this is the first time that somebody had ever said out loud into the open that Jesus, you're the Messiah, which means that you're the chosen one. You're the one that we've been looking for thousands of years. You're that guy. That's who I think you are. And not only are you that guy, but we believe that you're the Son of God. Like, you're not just a human Messiah. You are a human Messiah who is also the Son of God. It was this profound statement that that Peter makes, which probably surprised everybody because every time Peter spoke, he said something dumb, right? But and that's kind of what Jesus is getting at with what he says next. Look at verse 17. He says, Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood. In other words, you're not smart enough to figure this out on your own, Peter, but by my Father in heaven. That should make some of you in this room who don't feel all that smart at times feel good about yourself because, you know, the good thing about God, he reveals himself to us, and that's exactly what happened here. He revealed to Peter who Jesus was. And then Jesus says something pretty profound. In fact, what Jesus says next is something that theologians and church people have been arguing about and fighting about for thousands of years. In fact, people were killed over an interpretation of what Jesus said next. It was that controversial. What Jesus says next is just, it's pretty controversial, but it's also completely different and completely new and amazingly profound. Look at what he says. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Now, if you notice, and if you remember in verse 17, Jesus calls Peter Simon, son of Jonah, and then here he says, now you're Peter. Well, earlier on, Jesus had given Simon, who his name we call Peter, a nickname, and given Peter as his nickname, and he says, he uses Peter's name as an illustration to kind of reiterate and emphasize Peter's confession. I got to ask you a question. Anybody know what the name Peter means? Anybody? It means rock, right? Do you know the Greek version of that? Anybody? Petra. There was a great 80s Christian rock band with that name, okay? You know? I mean, you guys should know. Maybe not. But the name Peter means rock. And what Jesus says here is he uses that name and it to kind of emphasize and reiterate the confession that Peter makes. And Peter's declaration that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, is the foundational statement, the rock that was so important. That's just the thing that Peter declared that was extremely, extremely powerful and very different and new. And if you know anything about our Catholic brothers and sisters, is that you know that they have a different interpretation of this. They interpret that Peter was actually the first, they give him the title of the first pope, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And this is one of those areas where we have to agree to disagree with our Catholic friends. But what Jesus is doing here is teaching that the foundational truth that Peter declared, that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, is the cornerstone or the rock upon which his church is going to be built. But I want to look back at that verse because there's a little phrase in that verse that we skip a lot of times, or maybe we focus on, but we miss out on what it's really saying, or maybe we don't miss out on it. Maybe we just need to be reminded of it because we forget about it a lot of times. Let me read the verse to you one more time. He says, I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock, and what's that little next phrase? I will build my church. I will build my church. Did you know that this is the first time the word church appears in our New Testament? And anytime something appears for the first time, you should probably pay attention, and you know, because it's probably pretty important. And Jesus teaches us two really important things about church in this little statement. First, he teaches us that he will build his church. Actually, he promises that he's going to build his church. And then he teaches us that it is his church. Now, we need to be reminded of that a lot of times, especially if we've been in church for a while or we've been Christians for a while. We forget this a lot of times, but we forget that the church is not our church. Like, this is not my church. It is not your church. It is not our church. It is Jesus' church. And he teaches us that. And he also teaches us that he will build the church. In other words, he's going to build the church. He promises to build the church on the foundation of himself. He being the Messiah, the Son of God, the chosen one that everybody was looking for. But there's something else in that little phrase that that most of us miss because we're churchgoers. Now, if you're here this morning and you're not a churchgoer, this is a great Sunday for you to be here because you're going to learn something about those of us who are churchgoers. And what you're going to learn is we're not as smart as we kind of portray ourselves to be a lot of times because we're confused about something that Jesus mentions in this church, or in this verse. See, Jesus, when he says, I will build my church, do you realize that he's promising to build something that is not in existence yet? In other words, Jesus is promising something new. He's promising something that wasn't yet in existence. He's promising something new. See, when Jesus said this, there was no church. You know what there was? There was the nation of Israel. And the nation of Israel, they saw themselves as God's chosen people because they had the law from God and all that. That's who they were. You had, there was the temple, the place where they sacrificed animals so that people could have forgiveness for their sins. There was that. There was the synagogue. There were synagogues all over the place, which were a little like, they were almost like what we think of when we think of church today, where they had teaching on every Sabbath, you know, and they looked into the scriptures together. That's what you had, but you had no church. Church was something new, and Jesus promises to build something that isn't yet. Jesus promises to build something that they didn't even know about yet. See, when we hear the word church, something immediately pops into mind. Like if I were to sit down across the table from you and say, will you list out the top three things that come to mind when I say the word church? You would be able to say something to me. Like if some of you would say a steeple, some of you would say a building, some of you would say people, some of you would say people I don't like. Some of you, you know, would say something would come to mind, right? But when Jesus says this to the disciples, nothing comes to mind. Because they have no concept of church. They have no idea of what it is that Jesus is talking about here, which means I think they have an advantage over us because most of what we think or we list out when we think of church is wrong. Don't believe me? Let me show you what I'm talking about here. Does anybody know what the Greek word for church is that Jesus uses here? Anybody know what that is? It's not like, you know, you're dumb if you know this, right? I mean, don't know this. But the Greek word for church is the word ekklesia. Ekklesia. Now, I want you to think about that word for just a minute. That's most of the time when we see that Greek word in the New Testament, it's translated as church. And if you know anything, this is a little translation lesson. You know that the Bibles that you have, that you use, whether you're using a Bible app this morning or you're using a paper Bible this morning, the New Testament was translated from the Greek language into the English language, and most of what we have is a word-for-word translation of the Greek into the English. That's what we read on a regular basis. And what's interesting is throughout the New Testament, there's this word-for-word translation from the Greek to the English, except when it comes to the word church. The word church is actually not a translation from the Greek. It is a substitution from a German word. You guys are going to walk out of here learning something this morning. The term church is actually a derivative of the German word, and I'm going to try and pronounce this right, Kirche. Okay, if you took German in school or you have German backgrounds and I'm mispronouncing it, you can correct me later. But I listened to it on Google Translate, and that's how it pronounced it for me. Kirche. I can trust Google Translate, you know, it's always believable. Kirche, that's what this word comes from. Now, what's interesting about this German word Kirche is it actually means house of the Lord or temple. It means house of the Lord or temple. And the reason that translators use the word church that comes from Kirche in our English New Testaments is because they're making an interpretive statement about what this word means. They're interpreting us that church actually means house of the Lord or temple, but they get it wrong. That's not actually what the word ecclesia means. See, the problem with the word church that comes from the German word Kirche is it's a throwback to the temple, which the temple was the house of the Lord, but it is no longer the house of the Lord. See, when we hear the word church, most of us, we think of things I go to church, right? How many of you said that this morning? We're going to church today. You said, I'm going to church. We said that, right? Or you're gonna say, or you ask somebody, hey, where do you go to church? My son had a friend that came with us last week, and I was like, where do you go to church, you know? Do you go to church anywhere? We say things like that, or we invite people to come to church with us. And the reason why we say those things is because we think of church like the German word Kirche represents, as a house of the Lord or a temple. That's why maybe when you were growing up, you heard somebody use the phrase, this is the house of God. You know, anybody ever heard that? Or maybe when you were little, you got in trouble for running in the house of God. Anybody do that? You know, like you don't run in the house of the Lord, you know, like God's against running. But the reason why people say that is because we have this understanding that church that comes from the German word Kirche, which means house of the Lord or temple. But the truth is, the word ecclesia has nothing to do with the house of the Lord or a temple. The term ecclesia has something, a completely different meaning. And when Jesus said, I will build my ecclesia, he wasn't predicting another house of the Lord, another temple. There already was a temple, and it was going to be destroyed. He predicted that. He was predicting something completely new. He was predicting something that they couldn't even imagine yet. And that's why he specifically uses that word ecclesia. Now, let me kind of show you why that's true, because throughout the New Testament, the word ecclesia is translated in different ways in different contexts. I want to show you one of them that comes out of Acts 19. It happens on one of Paul's missionary journeys. Paul, let me kind of tell you what's going on in Acts 19. Paul was in the city of Ephesus, and the city of Ephesus was filled with idols, and there were all these idol worshipers in the city of Ephesus, and then Paul shows up, and he starts telling people about Jesus, and these idol worshipers start leaving their idol worship to follow Jesus, which was really cool for Paul, but it was really bad for the people in the city that made the idols, because there was this really kind of lucrative industry in the city of Ephesus of idol making, and if you're an idol maker, and all of your idol making customers are, you know, you make idols for these customers, they start getting rid of their idols and following Jesus. Well, I mean, that's costing you business, right? And as a result of that, there was a bunch of commotion going on in the city. And so this silversmith by the name of Demetrius called together kind of a business meeting of all the idol makers of the city, kind of the idol makers union, to kind of share his concerns with them, because he was losing business and they were losing business. And then a riot breaks out in the city. They're really upset about losing business, and so they, you know, kind of break out a riot. And Luke, who is the writer of the book of Acts, says the entire city was in an uproar because of this riot. And he gives this description in Acts chapter 19, verse 32 of what's going on. And he uses the word ecclesia. But as you're going to see when I read it, ecclesia is not translated church, it's translated something else. I want to see if you can figure out what it is. Let's put that up on the screen. I'm going to read it and see if you can tell what it is. It says, the assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most people did not even know why they were there. Now, the word ecclesia that we translate church back in Matthew chapter 16 is translated another word here. Anybody kind of guess what it is? Oh, you guys are geniuses. Now, just imagine for a minute, if the word ecclesia was translated church in this verse, like it's translated church in many other verses, this is how it would read. You can put it up there. I think it has it. Did it have it, the substitute, where it says the church? Oh, I don't have that slide. Take the word assembly out and put the word church in there for a minute. It would read like this. It says, the church was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. And I'm pretty sure some of you have been in church business meetings that would reflect that statement. And some of you, when you think of church, you kind of think it is described in that way a lot of times. But that's not really the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that the term ecclesia was translated assembly in this verse. Now, why is it translated assembly in this verse and church in other verses? It's because the word ecclesia actually means assembly. That's what it means. It means assembly with a purpose. See, ecclesia was not a religious term. We've kind of co-opted it and given it religious terms. But the word ecclesia did not mean house of the Lord or temple like the German word Kirche means. It's a term that was widely used to describe an assembly or a civic gathering, like an assembly of soldiers or who are gathering for a purpose. Or in the case of this verse out of Acts 19, it represented an assembly of riot-making idol makers who were intent on stopping Christians from ruining their business. That's because the word ecclesia means this. It is a gathering of people for a specific purpose. That's just really what it is. A gathering of people for a specific purpose. So when you're at work this week and you get together for a meeting and the meeting is designed to work on a specific project, that's an ecclesia. You're gathering for a specific purpose, right? If you have a hobby or a club or something that you're a part of where you get together on a regular basis to do something for a purpose, that's an ecclesia. That's what the word means. I think that has enormous implications for how we think of church and why most of what we think when we think of church is actually wrong. Because when we think of church, we think of something like this, right? We think of something we go to. But if church isn't something like this and church isn't something we go to, but instead church is an assembly that's gathering for a purpose, man, that changes it completely. It almost makes this irrelevant. Actually, it does make this irrelevant. And it makes what we do as a result of getting together of extreme relevance, doesn't it? It changes how we think of church. So when Jesus says, I will build my ecclesia, I will build my church, I will build my assembly with a purpose, he wasn't predicting a place. He was predicting a people, but not just any people. He was predicting a people that would join him on his mission to transform the world which he was sending them out into. See, that changes what we think of when we think about church, right? That's why the early Christians, do you know what the early Christians were called? They weren't called Christians at first. Do you remember what they were called? They were called members of the way, which I love that little description. And the reason why they were called members of the way is because they were helping people find their way back to God through Jesus. And it didn't matter what your race was, or what your nationality was, or what your sex was, or where you were from, or where you weren't from, or who your mom was, or who your dad was, or where you grew up, or anything like that. All that mattered was that you could find your way back to God through Jesus. And that was what Jesus was saying and predicting that he was going to build. He was going to build a gathering of people who were sent out for a purpose to transform the world through Jesus. I think this changes what it means to be a part of a church, doesn't it? It should change what we think about when we think about church. See, when Jesus said, I will build my ecclesia, I will build my church, do you realize, maybe this will blow you away, he was predicting you and me. He said this thousands of years ago, and he had you and me in mind. He didn't have this building in mind. He didn't have St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome in mind. He didn't have First Baptist Downtown in mind, these buildings. He had you and me in mind. He was predicting a people. He was predicting a movement of followers who would love the world so well that people would want to know Jesus because of those followers. And this new movement that Jesus initiated back in Matthew 16 when he said, I will build my ecclesia, this is what we get to be a part of. Those of us who call ourselves followers of Jesus, we get to be a part of this new thing that Jesus started. And our little gathering or our little assembly that meets here at 350 North Blackstock Road that goes by the name Hub City Church is just one little part of the movement of God all over the world. That's such a great and healthy perspective. We're just one little part of what God is doing all over the world. Which reminds us that we're about way more than what happens here. But as this ecclesia of Jesus, as this assembly who is sent out with a purpose of following Jesus, you and I should be all about letting the world know the declaration that Peter made, that Jesus is the Messiah, the chosen one, the Son of God, who's come to save people from their sins and rescue them and bring them back into a relationship with him. And that's why we gather. That's why we assemble. That's why we get together every week. Maybe this is a shocker for some of you, but you know the reason why we meet every week isn't so you can check off some little religious box on your, you know, your calendar. You know, oh, I did my church thing this week. We also don't meet every week so that you can be a good Christian. We don't meet every week so that you can get an attendance certificate. In fact, this is really funny. Some of you may have grown up in churches where they had attendance certificates. Oh, I don't think any of you in here would get a certificate, by the way. Because none of you are that consistent, except maybe Esten. Esten, I think you're the most consistent person I know. Esten's here all the time. But the truth is, the reason we gather is so that we can be equipped and prepared to be the ecclesia of Jesus throughout the rest of the week. This should just be kind of a refueling time for us so that we can be the church at work, at school, at home, in our neighborhoods, at the gym, when we're doing whatever our hobbies are, that we realize that wherever we are the church. And we are the representatives of Jesus, like we talked about a few weeks ago, where Paul says, you're ambassadors for Christ. You're his representatives. And you can't be a representative when you huddle up. You're only a representative when you go to people who need to be represented too. I was thinking about this whole idea of being a part of this ecclesia. Who wouldn't want to be a part of this thing that Jesus predicted 2,000 years ago, whose mission is to transform the world and help people who don't know God come into a relationship with God? That's what we get to be a part of as the church, as this ecclesia. And if you're here this morning and you're not a part of this thing called that we call the church, you're not a follower of Jesus, I just want to remind you, it's really simple to become a follower of Jesus. Jesus says, follow me, and you just got to follow him, believe in him, that he's the Son of God who died on the cross and rose from the dead, and you're in. I mean, it's this pretty incredible deal. But here's what I want us to do in light of what Jesus teaches here. This is kind of our assignment, our homework for this week. I want to encourage you to change, to really do an assessment of what do you think about when you think about church? Like, what comes to mind? Do you, when you think about church, do you think of what the German word Kirche represents, kind of a house of the Lord or the temple, or do you think about an assembly that's gathering for a purpose? What do you think of? Be honest about what you think of when you think about church. And be honest about, then look at what Jesus says, because Jesus says that it's not a house of the Lord or a temple. Actually, remember, Jesus was pretty critical about the temple. He predicted that the temple was going to be destroyed, and it was destroyed. And he says, don't trust in the temple, trust in me. Do some assessment. And then I want to encourage you to do this. I want us to hold lightly to this place. Because I think if we hold tightly to a place, we forget that we are gathering for a purpose. We think we're gathering because of a place. And it can be a distraction to us. And it can cloud kind of how we view the world we live in. And instead of holding firmly to a place, that we would hold firmly to the mission that God's given us. The mission to make disciples. The mission to be Jesus representatives in our world. And so here's my encouragement. I want you to do and be what Jesus predicted 2,000 years ago. Jesus predicted you and me. So I want you to do and be, do representative as, I can't even use the right verbs. Sorry, Tara. I'm looking at you as a, Tara's like an English major. I'm like, I can't even talk this morning correctly. I apologize. Sorry, teacher. She's already critiquing me. But be the church. And when we gather each week, when we come together each week, let this time be a time where you're equipped and prepared to go out and be the representative of Jesus where you find yourself throughout the week. And I love hearing stories of some of you guys who have opportunities to kind of live out kingdom principles where you are in your workplace. And some of you guys share those with me, and I really should ask for permission to share those with the church as an encouragement. But I love that, because that is really what being the church is all about. It's letting people see Jesus in you out there. And so when we gather, say, how can I be empowered or encouraged or motivated to go out and follow Jesus better the rest of this week? Hold loosely to this place, but hold firmly to the mission that God's given us. I've been praying something for you guys since the beginning of the year, and I think I put this in the weekly update a few weeks ago. But I've been praying that each one of you who's a part of Hub City Church would have the opportunity and the courage, I think it takes both, the opportunity and the courage to share your faith with at least one person every month this year. That you would have the opportunity and the courage to share your faith with one person you know every month this year. That's how you can be the church. Let Jesus shine through you. Let's pray. God, forgive us for the times that we get wrong what it means to be a part of your ecclesia. So many times we make church all about a building, and we're thankful for the building. Lord, it's great to have a place to meet today. We're grateful for that. But we know that being church is about way more than this facility. And if being a part of a church is only about what happens for an hour on Sunday, we are really failures when it comes to being your followers. And so forgive us for making church all about this hour. Help us instead to really be the ecclesia of Jesus, who represent you at work and at school and in our neighborhoods and in our homes, who represent you well on a Monday through Saturday time frame, God. I thank you that 2,000 years ago you predicted us. And Lord, I just want to surrender us as your church that we call Hub City Church to you, because we are yours. And also, I ask that you would do what you promised. When you said you'll build your church, would you just build us into the people that you want us to be to make the difference that you want us to make. We love you. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.